Well, if you are a guest or not a regular attender here, like I said last time I preached, I've got some good news for you, and I've got some bad news. Most people want to know the bad news. Well, the bad news is we have three elders at this church. I'm one of them. And two of them are great preachers. They aren't preaching today. That's the bad news. The good news, you've got some great material. It is powerful, it is pertinent, and it can be life-changing if you let it. I'm not a great speaker, but I've got great material to speak about. So before I pray, and before we get into our passage, and we're going to be following along in Luke, as we have for many months now, Luke 19:11, if you want to get ready. But before we get started, I want to tell a short story. I actually shared this. I did preach at Wayside a few months ago, and I shared this. But there was a POW from the Vietnam War. His name was Jack Sands. He was a fighter pilot, and he was shot down early in the war, and he was captured, and he was taken to a place maybe some of you remember. It was called the Hanoi Hilton. It was an ironic name. It was a very despicable place where the Vietnamese kept the American soldiers. And for 7 years, Jack Sands was kept in a bamboo cage about 5 by 5. So I'm a little over 6 foot, so I don't know if you can imagine, but for 7 years. And he was let out periodically, but he had almost no contact with people. And he was 20-some hours a day in that bamboo cage. Now, right away, Jack realized he was going to go nuts if he didn't do something, right? Just literally, psychologically, he was going to lose it. So what he started doing, he liked to play golf. And so what he did is, early on in that 7-year period, when he woke up early before the sun came up, he would envision playing 18 holes of golf. And he would take 3 to 5 hours in this mental exercise. And so he would start by envisioning the first hole. He'd envision addressing the ball. He'd know where the wind was coming from. He'd see the grass. He would just spend hours visualizing playing golf. He would hit every shot. Each day was a little different. They're all good shots. And he did that for 7 years. What it did is it helped him from going crazy. But the point of the story is, after he came back, he was very emaciated and not in very good shape. After a few weeks of getting some food and being able to walk again, he went out and played a round of golf. Hadn't played in close to eight years. He shot the best score he'd shot in his life by 10 strokes. All right, so he shot in the 90s, which is about what I do. And if you don't play golf, it's hard to shoot 90, if you're honest, if you don't cheat. 90's hard. He shot in the 70s. He hadn't played in 8 years. Now, there's probably lots of reasons why that is, but the reason I'm telling this story is our imagination and our minds have so much power to affect what we do and who we are, right? And God knows that, right? That's why he gave us the word, and that's why he asks us to renew our minds and to be affected by the word. And so if that can happen to Jack Sands, what I want to exhort you here today is you don't have to take 7 years. Take 25 minutes right now. Use your imagination. Engage with me. Engage with the word. Don't sleep. Don't look at your phone so much. Just pay attention, right? That's all I'm asking. Use your mind. Use your imagination. Follow along. Today we have a story, really like a parable, easy to follow. So take 25 minutes and be like Jack Sands. And that'll overcome the fact that I'm an average speaker, right? Because it's good material and your mind is powerful. So let's go. I'm going to read the passage and then I'm going to pray. So Luke 19, verse 11 through 27. You can follow along if you want. And again, this is Jesus telling a story. As they heard these things, he, Jesus, proceeded to tell a parable. Because he was near Jerusalem, and because they supposed that the kingdom of God was to appear immediately. So he said, therefore, a nobleman went into a country, a far country, to receive for himself a kingdom and then return. Calling 10 of his servants, he gave them 10 minas. And he said to them, engage in business until I come. But his citizens hated him, and they sent a delegation after him, saying, we do not want this man to reign over us. When he returned, having received the kingdom, he ordered these servants to whom he had given the money to be called to him, that he might know what they had gained by doing business. The first came before him, saying, Lord, your mina has made 10 minas more. And he said to him, well done, good servant. Because you've been faithful in very little, you shall have authority over 10 cities. And then the second man came, saying, Lord, your mina has made 5 minas. And he said to him, you are to be over 5 cities. Then another came, saying, Lord, here's your mina, which I have kept laid away in a handkerchief. For I was afraid of you, because you are a severe man. You take what you do not deposit, and you reap what you do not sow. And he said to him, I will condemn you with your own words, you wicked servant. You knew that I was a severe man, taking what I did not deposit and reaping what I did not sow? Well, why then did you not put my money in the bank? And at my coming back, I would have collected it at least with interest. And he said to those who stood by, take the mina from him and give it to the one who has 10. And they said to him, well, Lord, he already has 10 minas. I tell you that to everyone who has, more will be given, but from the one who has not, even what he has will be taken away. But for these enemies of mine, who did not want me to reign over them, bring them here and slaughter them before me. Well, this is a pretty straightforward story or parable, and so all I'm going to try and do today is provide some context, right? There are things that are happening, the what, why, and how of what's going on here. And then I'm going to try and draw attention to what Jesus is emphasizing, right? That makes sense. And then probably most importantly, I'm going to try and draw application for us, right? So context, what did Jesus emphasize, and what do we need to apply and take away? And so if you think of the parable as a play, right? Like maybe you're taking the kids to a play. We have some actors and we have some scenes. So the nobleman is one of the actors, right? We're going to talk about that. The nobleman's servants, they would be other actors in this play. And then there's the citizens of the country, right? And the two scenes are pretty basic. You have an opening scene and a finale, right? So if you kind of envision that, we're going to walk through those things. If you're taking notes, I would just mostly listen, jot down ideas in your head or on paper through the context and characters, and then I would really pay attention on kind of what Jesus is emphasizing and the application at the end. So I would mentally or physically take notes, as you will, but let's focus on the last 2 points. So context. So kind of the where, what, and why. So if you remember last week, one of the two good preachers preached on Zacchaeus, right? And it was an excellent message. And so Jesus, everybody knows that story and about wee little Zacchaeus. And so Jesus has just finished up being at his house, right? And Zacchaeus was radically converted. And now Jesus is heading to Jerusalem, right? And Jerusalem is about 18 miles away. It's about a 7-hour journey. And Jesus is heading there, and he's been heading for Jerusalem because he knows that's where he's going to be ultimately crucified and pay the price that we need to have paid for all of us. So Jesus is heading down. So where is he? He's heading down to Jerusalem. He's leaving Zacchaeus' house. Well, what's happening? Well, first of all, there's all kinds of rumors swirling around, right? Because people who've been following him for a while think, okay, this guy is raising people from the dead. He's healing people. He controls the weather. He rebukes demons. Doesn't fear anybody. Seems to know more than everybody else, even the Pharisees and the teachers. This guy might be a good king. And there were, at the time, almost everybody ready to go and make him the king. They thought he was the Messiah. They were right. But they envisioned a Messiah like David, right? A serious sword at his side, big white stallion, serious kicking of butt, you know, with peoples around him. That's sort of the Messiah they had in mind, right? Which you don't blame them. I think everybody did. I don't think anybody got it, the 12 disciples or anybody else. So you've got a whole bunch of people here ready to make Jesus king, and they're heading to Jerusalem where the king will be crowned, right? And if you remember, as you read in other passages or later on in Luke, they're raising palm branches, right? This is when they're doing that, and they're saying, Hosanna, Hosanna, you know, glory to the king, and all kinds of stuff on the road as he's going to Jerusalem. So that's what's about to happen, or what is happening. So why does Jesus take this time then to share this parable, right? The what, the where, and the why? Well, he was fully aware of what all his followers were thinking. And he knew it was wrong. Not wrong that he was the Messiah. That part was right. What was wrong is this was not going to be a coronation like they're expecting, right? They are going to be gravely disappointed very soon. They're going to leave him. They're going to be shocked that Jesus would allow or that the Romans and the Jewish authorities would crucify him. So he knows they're about to be disappointed. He understands that although someday he's going to come in the manner of which they are thinking, this week isn't it. In fact, it's going to be, still hasn't come, right? We're still waiting for that time when Jesus comes in this sort of Davidic conquering war hero ruler. That's coming someday soon, but it's not happened yet. And so he needs to help the followers then, and I would argue maybe as importantly us, because he still hasn't come back. He needs to inform them and help them give a perspective and understand what's really going to happen and what he expects of them, right? What as a king. So this is a very important parable for the people then, but just as important for you and I, because the parable is going to emphasize what Jesus thinks is really important about what happens between him being crucified and when he does come as a king or the nobleman in the story. So that's the context. Let's get to our first character in this play, if you will. If you read verse 12, he said, "Therefore, a nobleman went into a far country to receive for himself a kingdom and then return." So, one piece of context that you may not be aware of that the readers would have is this is actually a real story. It really happened. There was a king, a nobleman named Archelaus, and he actually is mentioned in Matthew. If you go back and look in your Bible, when Herod the Great died, you know, Herod the Great, who killed all the innocents, you know, killed all the babies Jesus' age, he died. Archelaus was his son and eventually took over for him. Well, what happened is Archelaus was supposed to be the next king, taking over for Herod the Great, and a whole bunch of Jews went to Caesar, and actually some of Archelaus's family went to Caesar and said, "We don't like this guy. He's a bad dude. We don't want him running our kingdom." And so this story actually happened 30-some years before Jesus shared this parable. They all went together to Rome, right? The Jews, some of Archelaus's family, and there was a big brouhaha on whether Archelaus was going to come back and be the expected king. And so this really happened. So the people would have been aware of that. In fact, on the way to Jerusalem from Jericho, Archelaus's palace is up on a hill, right? So it would be right there as he's talking and sharing this. So the nobleman is Jesus, but they would get the, they would understand the delay, right? He was supposed to be king, but there was a delay. He had to go all the way to Rome, wait a while, and he came back. So they get that. And that's so Jesus is using a historical figure that they understand. But Jesus is the nobleman, right, in the story. He's the character, even though in some ways Archelaus would have been a bad nobleman. Jesus is the good nobleman. So they would understand the delay. They would understand that some people, maybe a lot of people, didn't want Archelaus to be king, right? And so anyway, so that's the nobleman. We have Jesus in our set of characters. The next set are the servants of the nobleman, right? There's 10 of them, it says. So calling 10 of his servants, he gave, this is before he goes to be crowned and accept his crownship or lordship. He gave them 10 minas. And he said to them, servants, here's a mina each, one for each of the 10. Engage in business. Now, the actual translation is something like, do business with what I, you know, with what I give you, do business, right? So that was a command to his servants. And people often think, why 10? Some commentators think 10 is a general number, because Jesus wanted to communicate this is for all his disciples, right? He didn't say 12, where people might have thought it was his 12. He said 10 as a general number, because it's all of us. It's all of them, it's all of you. A mina, in case you're wondering, roughly in today's terms, would be about $12,000 to $15,000. So, you know, there was another parable of the talents given in another part of the Bible. That was a lot more than the minas. In this parable, it's about $12,000 to $15,000, and all of them get that amount equally, right? Each one gets that. There's no difference in as there was in the parable of the talents. Now, there is pretty good consensus on what the minas represent. I think most scholars, and as I read it, I feel the same way. The minas represent the gospel or the word, the good news. That's what each one is given, right? And so each of his all his servants are given the gospel, salvation, the good news. And in that context, he's saying, go do business. And the implication would clearly be kingdom business, because that's what the treasure is. It's a kingdom gospel treasure. Can it mean what you do with your money? Yes, that could be a sort of outer layer application, but I think it's the gospel, right? These are his servants versus the citizens, and they are given the gospel, and they're expected to engage in business, right? So that's what he says to these guys, and then he moves on to the next group. And the next group it talks about in verse 14, it says, but the citizens hated him and sent a delegation after him saying, we do not want this man to reign over us. So the citizens hated this nobleman. And if you go back to the real life story 30-some years previously, this Archelaus, he actually killed about 3,000 Jews, and they really hated him, right? And there were actually 8,000 Jews in Rome sort of protesting against him becoming the king when he went back there. And not only that, his own brother and a whole bunch of his family went back and said, hey, we're with them. This guy really is a bad dude. We don't want him. We'd rather have his brother be put up as king. So there was a big to-do. But the citizens of the country did not want the nobleman to rule. And it says so. It's pretty clear. So these are the characters in the play. And now the next part of the parable, if you will, same characters, but the scene changes and we go to the finale, right? And so we're sometime in the future. And actually, it's a future that hasn't even happened yet, right? This goes back 2,000 some years ago, but we still haven't seen the day the Messiah comes back to judge and rule, right? We're waiting for that. So it's, This is that someday in the future. And now this is a description from Jesus describing what happens when he returns. So he comes back, and the first people he addresses are his servants, right? He comes back to his servants. In verse 16, he says, "The first came before him, saying, 'Lord, your mina has made 10 minas more.' And he said to him, 'Well done, good servant, because you have been faithful in a very little, you have authority over 10 cities.' And then the second came, saying, 'Lord, your mina has made 5 minas.' And he said to him, 'And you are to be over 5 cities.'" So the nobleman, when he met with his servants, he commended them first, gave reason for his commendation, and then he rewarded them. And so, even though it's not emphasized here, so think about this. These guys were given, each of them about $12,000. And the first one did great. He gave him back about 120, right? That's a pretty good return, even if it's 10 or 20 or 30 years. The next guy gave him back like 60. Good return, right? But for that relatively small amount of money, would you expect to be made a ruler of 10 cities? I mean, that's kind of like a governor, right? Think about it. Or even of 5 cities. Wouldn't it be kind of cool to be the ruler of like Aurora, Oswego, Yorkville, Naperville, and Plainfield, right? So for very relatively little faithfulness, and they even insinuated that it was the minas that did the work, right? It wasn't anything they had. They're given some, they threw it out there, some came back, and wow, they're made governor of 10 cities or mayor of 5 cities or whatever. So the implication is that God gives them something they didn't have, and then if they're just a little bit faithful, they get a whole bunch more. That's a good deal. In case you don't know about business, I'm in business. That's a good deal, all right? That's a deal you want, right? If you want to invest in something, that's what you want to invest in, right? And so the nobleman is generous in giving and generous in rewarding, right? For the people who just do what he asked them to do. Put it to work. Go do business for the kingdom. So these are the good servants. They're humble. They don't make excuses. And you can even see, like, let's say it's, I'm one of those 10 and my brother's the first one, and my brother goes, "Hey, you gave me one, I'm giving you 10. And I'm thinking, "I only got 5. First thing I'm going to say, "Well, he got lucky, and I only did 5, but I'd start making excuses." This guy didn't make excuses. "I have 5, and God moved right on, and he blessed him, right? To the same, proportionally, the same kind of blessing. They made no excuses. They really were humble. They said, "You gave me mina, your mina made it, here's what I did." Boom, they get blessing. So now we move on to one of his servants, and Jesus, in his own words, describes him as the wicked servant. Frankly, when I read this, that does seem a little harsh in my sort of way, I think. So that might seem a little harsh to you as well. But I'm not writing it, right? I'm just relaying what he says. He calls him a wicked servant. So let me read. He says, "Lord, here is your mina, which I laid away in a handkerchief. For I was afraid of you, because you are a severe man. You take what you did not deposit and reap what you did not sow." And Jesus said to him, "I'll condemn you with your own words, you wicked servant. You knew that I was a severe man, taking what I did not deposit and reaping what I did not sow. Why didn't you go put the money in the bank then, you knucklehead? I might have collected it with interest." And then he stood by, and then those who stood by said, "Hey, go take what this guy has and give it to the guy who has 10. And then everybody around him, probably like we would say, "Well, yeah, that doesn't seem that fair, right? He only has one. Why don't you let him keep one? And that guy has 10 cities, man. He wasn't the others." And then Jesus says, "No, do it." That's the way it's going to be. He says, in fact, he says, "Not only what you have, if you're not faithful, it's going to be taken away from you," right? And he reiterates that there in the scripture. So, he says, "Take the mina and give it to one who has 10. And then when they complained, he says, "I tell you that to everyone who has, more will be given. But from the one who has not, even what he has will be taken away." So a couple of interesting points on this wicked servant, right? So there's roughly 16 or 17 verses in this parable. Well over a third of it is all taken up on the wicked servant. So by far, in our play, if you will, the most emphasis, the most words are dedicated to the wicked servant. I think we have to take that as a point of emphasis, right? I mean, I don't think Jesus and all his wisdom takes over a third of this parable to emphasize one part unless it was important and he wanted us to deal with and understand it, right? So I think that's a very big takeaway. Another takeaway is he's the only one who made an excuse, right? Now, he probably had to, right? Because he realized it doesn't say of the 10 where this one fit in. It only shares, you know, the first one made 10, the next one made 5. So he probably felt he had to make an excuse, right? Make something up. Now, he says the nobleman is severe and reaps where he doesn't sow. Now, we don't know if he actually believes that, right? He may have. Or if he's making it up, right? An excuse. You know how when you catch your kid and they're in trouble, all the wonderful excuses they can come up with, they are very creative, right? And so I don't know, we don't know for sure if this was a made-up excuse or if he actually believed it. But now, the nobleman never actually says, that's who I am. But he says, I'll use your own words if you think that's the case. If you think I'm that severe and harsh, then take no risk, go put it in the bank, and get back a half a mina. Now, the implication here, I think, is if he just would have done that, he wouldn't have been commended, but he very likely would have got to keep the mina, keep the small percentage of a mina he made in interest, and actually rule over 1.5 cities or something, right? That's the way that was progressing. So really, the only thing you can do that messes you up is do nothing. Right? To not obey the nobleman and have nothing to show for it. And so that is kind of the implication of this servant. The other thing he did is he slandered him, right? Because God describes himself. You want to know what God thinks of himself? There's lots of descriptions, but Exodus 34 is a good one. He describes himself. This is God telling Moses as he marches before him who he is. He says, I am merciful. I am gracious. I am slow to anger and abounding in steadfast love and faithfulness and keeping steadfast love for thousands, forgiving iniquity and transgression and sin. So that's how God describes himself, right? Not how the wicked servant described God. And on top of that, if you just see what God did or what Jesus did, what did he do? He gave him something. And if they just didn't mess up, he gave him a whole bunch more on top of that. So he didn't take or reap where he didn't sow. In fact, he gave, and then he gave more, right? That's kind of the actual actions of the nobleman. So this wicked servant either really believed or was just slandering the nobleman, right? And this is where I think just want to make a point relative to this wicked servant. What you think about God matters. Bad thinking about God has really bad implications, right? And we're in a society where there are amazingly bad thoughts about God and regarding God and directed at God, right? It really does matter. What this servant thought, if you follow through with his thinking, is, man, I don't know what to do. I'm just going to do nothing, right? And the scripture's pretty clear over and over throughout Luke and anywhere else that isn't the way the kingdom operates, right? We'll see later as we look at application that fruitfulness matters, right? Results matter. What you do with your life here on earth matters, and it has eternal implications, right? Amen. And that's kind of the point, I think, the biggest point that Jesus is making in this story is, for Christians, what you do here matters. And it matters in tangible ways, and it's going to be measured someday, right? Actually, there's going to be an actual accounting, right? I think that's important to remember. Bad thinking about God matters. We need to be informed about who God is and what the rules are in his kingdom. So, one obvious question here as I end on the wicked servant and my discussion on the wicked servant is, I think a question I had, a lot of people have, is, in spite of what happened, is this wicked servant saved? Right? Now, if you go back to the parable of the talents back in Matthew, that guy, now it's different. That guy clearly wasn't. I don't know if you remember. He says, grab that guy and throw him with the people who are going to be cut up and slaughtered, right? Now, in this case, it doesn't really say that. In fact, I just don't know. I honestly don't know. And I think perhaps it's ambiguous for a reason, right? Because if you're in the potential shoes of being the wicked servant, God probably wants you to be a little uncomfortable, right? By being called wicked, you can maybe infer that he isn't saved, right? That either he was a false Christian or a false servant or a bad servant. But by being called wicked implies something. But Jesus, the nobleman, doesn't say grab him and throw him with the rest. But he takes away what he has. And so what comes to my mind, if you're familiar with 1 Corinthians 3, where it says, according to the grace God's given me, like a skilled master builder, I lay a foundation. Someone else is building on it. Let each one take care of how he builds. For no one can lay a foundation other than that which is laid, which is Jesus. Now, if anyone builds on a foundation with gold, silver, precious stones, wood, hay, and straw, each one's work will become manifest, for the day will disclose it, because it will be revealed by fire, and the fire will test what sort of work each one has done. And if the work that anyone has built on the foundation survives, he will receive a reward. And if anyone's work is burned up, he will suffer loss, though he himself will be saved, but as through fire. Now, I personally think that's my personal application of what I think happened to this wicked servant. I think that's a pretty good characterization, right? Everything you had got burned up. You aren't going to be rewarded. You're still grateful to be saved. You're not thrown in with the citizens that are against Christ. But it's like you came through fire and you lost everything. You're like, and there wasn't any gold or silver. Now, that's just my opinion. You can read and decide that. But I think we can all agree that the wicked servant minimally gets into heaven as going through fire or doesn't get in at all. And that Jesus spent a lot of time talking about this wicked servant for our benefit, right? For lots of reasons. So one other thing I want to highlight before we start to move on towards our application is something interesting about God. If you look at this parable and you see it throughout the Bible, you've heard of the way to reward people, you can either use a carrot or a stick, right? And for you young people, the thought of rewarding by a carrot is, if you think about a donkey and you want him to move and obey you, you can maybe hold out a carrot and keep walking and he'll keep following you because he likes carrots and he wants a carrot and a carrot's good. And if he does good, you give him a carrot and he's happy and he does good. Another way to motivate is with a stick, right? And some people whack the donkey, and that gets them to move too, right? And I think it's interesting because some people respond differently. We all respond differently. Sometimes I like carrots. Sometimes I need a stick, right, in my job. Or if you think of athletics, right, coaches do this all the time, right? Sometimes they give you a carrot, and sometimes they give you the stick. They give you whatever you need to get going, right? And I think that's what God does. He wants us to be motivated by rewards and love and affection. He wants to win us that way, and that's his preferred way, but he's willing to do it with a stick too, right? Because he wants us to get where we got to go, right? And you can see in this parable there are both ways, right? There is the lavish rewards and commendations, and there's also like, come on, man, get in there. I'm going to do whatever I have to do to get you going. So then the last player in our play, if you will, or the last set of actors, are the citizens. And he doesn't spend much time on them, right? Early on he says, they didn't want me to reign. And at the end, he says, now bring these enemies of mine who did not want me to reign over them. Bring them here and slaughter them before me. So again, this isn't the kind of stuff I might feel like writing if I'm, you know, trying to encourage people. But it's there, right? And we've got to deal with it. And so he didn't mess around. There wasn't any appeal. And in our real story with Archelaus, it's actually what happened, right? He went to Rome. He finally got Caesar to make him originally sort of a half king and later on a king. And when he got back, he took care of all the Jews that went to Rome to petition against him, right? It wasn't pretty. There was actually retribution to the people who stood against him and him becoming king. And so I don't think we have to say a lot here. These are the folks who shouted, crucify him, when the Pilate tried to let Jesus go. He says, do you want your king? And they said, no, crucify him, right? That's the same folks who tried to stone him and accused him of being Beelzebub. These are the citizens, right? Not just Jews, but anybody who opposes Christ and his future reign, this is what happened. And I would just say this, I don't want to dwell on this, it's really kind of a morbid in some ways, but you don't want to be this person, right? I don't think that's pretty clear. But you don't want people you know to be that person either, right? And so part of the task of engaging in business with our gospel mina is doing everything you can to influence your wife, your husband, your brother, your sister, your kids, your neighbors, your coworkers, your fellow students, so they aren't part of that. Right now, many, maybe most of them are. Maybe not your family, but I mean, you go out into the world, this is a world that opposes Christ to his face, and it isn't going to be pretty, right? And so part of the beauty of not only do we get to earn rewards, which are going to be better than we think, we get to help other people, by God's grace, not face the judgment that these citizens faced. It's real, it's coming, and it's going to be ugly, right? This is ugly stuff, right? It isn't nice little tidy stuff. So we have the noblemen, we have the servants, we have the citizens. We have the opening scene and the finale. And so now here's where we're going to try and tie it together, and I want to make some application for us, right? So if you're taking notes or just for your own thought process, I'm going to try and make 2 points, which will include a lot of application, hopefully. And then I'm going to end with an exhortation on how we can kind of go away and wrestle with these, with the 2 points, okay? So the first point of application is there is a day of reckoning, right? I mean, if you read through this parable, everything kind of points to that day and what happens on that day, right? So you can call it a day of accountability. The Bible actually mostly calls it a day of judgment. But that day is coming. And as sure as the sun came up today, and as sure as all the things that happen in our lives on a daily basis, that day is coming. And if you read Revelation 22, it says it a different way. It says, behold, I'm coming soon, and I am bringing recompense with me to repay each one for what he has done. This is Jesus talking in Revelations. So there is recompense for each of our actors, right? The good servant gets recompense, and that looks pretty good. The wicked servant, not so much, and we don't know what happens. And the citizens, that recompense is ugly. And Jesus makes that clear. And he wants all of us to, right? The reason he's drawing these characters out is he wants us to figure out where we fit and where those around us fit and do something about it, right? That's why he's sharing this story. And his concern mostly is for those of us who might not get the fact that the gospel requires action and fruitfulness, right? On the day of accounting, we're going to be judged. We're going to be, it's going to be determined how good as stewards of the gospel we were. And the only difference between the good servant and the wicked servant, well, I guess there's more than one. But the biggest difference is one was fruitful and one wasn't, right? So he makes it pretty clear. The insinuation is if the guy just would have put it in the bank and made a little interest, he would have been at the low end, but he would have been included, right? So fruitfulness matters. As Jesus says in Luke multiple times, in Luke 3, he says, even now the axe is laid to the root of the trees. Every tree, therefore, that does not bear good fruit is cut down and thrown into the fire. Later in chapter 6, Jesus says again through Luke that you will be known by your fruit. That's how people are going to know you. You either have good fruit or bad fruit or no fruit. So multiple times in Luke, Jesus is talking about, hey, how you're going to be measured, how you're going to be judged, how you're going to know how you're doing is by your fruit. Now, one of my favorite books, and probably most of you have heard me mention this before, it's a super Christian book written by a non-Christian, right? It's called Seven Habits of Highly Effective People. And one of the things I love about that book is it says, start with the end in mind, right? And so the author kind of goes through and says, you know, if you want to live a good life, here's how you do it. Start with your funeral. Think about who you want there. Think about what you want them to say about you. Do you want a whole bunch of people that came to Christ around? Do you want family? What do you want? Think about your funeral. Think about what you want to have happened for the last 70 years. Start there. Now, go to where you are and work your way there, right? I love that. That's what the Bible says, right? This is just an unchristian man who took it and took a biblical principle. It's really true. Start with the end in mind. The end matters. In fact, all that matters is the end, so we need to live in light of that. And so that's what this parable is saying. Keep the end, the finale, the final scene in mind, and live your life. There is a day, it matters, we need to live in light of it. Faith is measured for everyone. The good, the bad, the indifferent, they all get measured. They all get graded. You know, my son's looking at colleges. Some of these goofy colleges now don't require any test scores, and they don't give you grades. Good luck with that, you know. I don't know, I'm sure there's some case to be made for that, but real colleges don't require tests to get in, and they don't give you grades when you get there, right? That's not what the kingdom of heaven is going to be like, all right? Maybe that works for higher education. That doesn't work in real life, and that's not going to work in eternity. There are grades given. We get a grade, and it doesn't even matter if you like it or not. It's just the way it is. And let me say this. Although we will be expected to have been fruitful, we'll be judged by our fruit, we aren't saved by our fruit, right? All fruit is the evidence of the gospel in us and through us. And really what Jesus is saying is if there is no fruit, the implication is there was no gospel. There was no gospel work done if there's no fruit. That's pretty clear throughout the whole Bible. So we aren't saved, we're saved by faith alone, grace alone, through Christ alone. That is clear. But the way you determine that salvific gospel, salvation, that salvific gospel fruit is what your life looks like, what you did with it, how the gospel interacted with other people and you. So start with the end in mind. Faith is measured in fruitfulness. We're not saved by our fruitfulness, but saving faith is judged by fruitfulness. And any kind of fruit's going to get like a crazy reward. Don't forget that, right? You know where Jesus says heaven's going to be kind of way beyond what you imagine? So any little thing you do, you get crazy rewards, right? You do a little, man, you're ruling cities. You do a lot, you're ruling, you know, countries, right? So that is a principle throughout, and that is part of this parable. Any kind of fruitfulness is going to be amazingly rewarded. Don't be caught off guard, right? Because there's some other parables throughout the Gospels where they talk about people getting caught off guard, right? The bridesmaids, people with the lamp, somebody's running the house and getting drunk and beating the servants, and the master comes home. So there's a whole bunch of stuff you know, about don't be get caught off guard. And so the end's coming. A day of reckoning is coming. Don't be caught off guard. So point first of 2 points to take away, I think, from this parable is there is a day of reckoning. It's not a bad thing. For those who love Jesus, it's a good thing. But it should be sobering, right? If not for any other reason than the people around us who need to hear the gospel and apart from it are going to have a horrific end. Second point of application, what you think and know about God matters a lot. What you think and know about God matters a lot. You need to know the rules, right? Let's say you're a servant and you think it doesn't matter how fruitful you are. What happens at the end? Bad, right? Doesn't matter what you think. The rules are laid out, right? If you are a servant of Christ and you are not fruitful at the end of your life, that's bad. You need to know that rule, right? I love strategy games, right? I love, you know, Settlers of Catan. I like Risk. I like all those kind of goofy games, right? What do? You figure out how you get rewarded and what the best strategy is, and you implement that, right? Well, Jesus is clearly saying that for us, for his followers. Here's the rules. Just do a little good for me with the gospel, and you're going to get crazy rewards. Those aren't bad rules. There is a judgment. People may not like it, but it doesn't matter what you like. That's what it is. That's what's happening, right? There is judgment. Live with it. Deal with it. Live your life like there is judgment, right? That'll affect you. Don't get caught up in making up your own rules because they don't work, right? People love to make up their rules. You know, I bet I've heard 100 times, I'm not going to serve a God who would kill his own son. What a horrible God. All right. Play by your rules. See where it gets you, man. He's saying this isn't going to work out so good for you, right? You don't get to make up the rules. I don't get to make up the rules. The liberals don't get to make up the rules. The conservatives don't get to make up the rules. The elite academics don't make up the rules. The poor don't make up the rules. God made up the rules, and they're in his word, and he gave it to us. And it's pretty clear, right? Not everything's completely clear, but it's pretty clear. So what you think about God and what you think about the rules matter a lot, right? It's gonna affect how you live. It should affect how you live, right? And what we think is what we do, right? Think and be, or whatever. There's that famous book, right? Think and as you think, therefore you are. I mean, think rightly about God. Read what God says. Have the word be a part of your life. And you're in good shape, right? You're in good shape. The mind is work on their own. The gospel is powerful. His word is powerful. What you think is important. So you need to know what's important. God informs us. He calls us to renew our minds, to be obedient, to be a follower of what he says. And he expects that we follow it on his terms, right? I think that's clear. So second point, what you think about God matters. Knowing who God is and what the rules are is very important. Being in the Word, hearing the Word, being affected by the Word is really important. That's point two. So point one, there is a day of reckoning. There's a day when we all get graded. Point two really matters what we think about God. We need to know his word, be affected by his word. The rules do matter. So in closing, I want to try and help you be encouraged, right? I think overall this is an encouraging message, even though it's sobering, right? I think it's encouraging for lots of reasons. We get crazy rewards. We're given things, minus the gospel, through no effort or work on our own. We do have a God who's gracious, slow to anger, merciful, long-suffering, forgives for generations. That's all good news. We have the ability to make a difference for other people, right? Minimally, your kids, your siblings, your family, your roommates, we can make a big difference, right? We can bring people who are citizens that are going to be judged into the family of good servants. We can do that. That's so awesome. But we need to be faithful, and we need to be faithful starting with little things. Starting with little things right now. Hudson Taylor said this, a little thing is a little thing, but being faithful in a little thing is a big thing. And that's what this parable's kind of saying. So a little thing's just a little thing, but being faithful in a little thing is a big thing. So you don't have to start by saving part of China, right? Start by reading the Word. Start by affecting your own soul. That's fruit. Start by the closest people around you, the people you know best, right? A little thing is a little thing, but being faithful in a little thing is a big thing. And be faithful now, right where you are. As I pointed out, even if that wicked servant just would have put his mina in the bank, he'd have been okay, right? Doesn't take much. You know, God is doing the work. Doesn't take much. And so I want to close with a story, hopefully to encourage you. I heard this story, I bet 30 years ago, and I still remember it to this day. On a beach in Australia, there was a man walking, and at this time of the year, there are millions of starfish along the beach, stranded along the beach, miles and miles, millions of starfish. Man's walking, and he sees a little kid. And he sees the little kid every once in a while bending down, picking up one of these starfish and whizzing it out into the ocean. And so he finally walks down. And he says, "Hey, little boy, what are you doing?" The little boy says, "You know, these starfish, most of them are going to die. The tide's going out, the sun's coming out, and any that don't get back in the water, they all die. And every year, there's millions of dead starfish along this beach." And so the guy goes, "Well, there's 20 miles of beach. You aren't going to make much difference." And the little boy picks up the starfish, and he whizzes it out in the water. He says, "Well, I made a difference to that one." And I think it's easy for us in life, and I'll just use myself as an example. I'm a dad. I'm a father and a husband. I'm a church laborer. I have a job. You know, sometimes I can be overwhelmed with all the stuff going around and all the things I think I need to do or I should do, right? And so that helps remind me that I could pick up one little starfish, whiz it out into the water and save one star. Yeah, 10 million other things don't get done, but that made a difference, right? And I can keep doing that. And so as we leave today, I think the Lord want you to be like that little boy, right? Don't be overwhelmed with the weight of the world. There's tons of ways you can be faithful, and you're going to be required to be faithful. I don't want to minimize that. And you're going to be required to be fruitful. I don't want to minimize that. But you don't have to be overwhelmed, right? What's the starfish you can pick up and whiz out into the ocean, right? It's in the area of being fruitful. You know, to be a good servant, right? It looks different for everybody. There's no one answer, right? There's no one amount. It's just fruitfulness. It'll look different for Mike than it does for Josh or myself, but it looks like something. And all you got to do is start at the littlest level where you're at, pick up a starfish, whiz it out there, be faithful.